Dr. Natalie Rowe here, who will be introducing our speaker. Dr. Rowe is the director of the physics division at the Berkeley Lab. She's an experimental particle physicist and observational cosmologist. She's been with the lab since 1989, joining as a postdoc fellow after earning her undergrad degree in physics from Harvard and her PhD at Stanford. She's had a very distinguished research career, has also served on a number of committees at the lab, is one of the founding members of the Women Scientists and Engineers Council. She's also served on many national committees and panels, and is a fellow of the American Physical Society and past chair of the APS Division of Particles and Fields. So we're very honored and pleased to have Dr. Rowe here, and I'll turn it over to her.
All right. Introducing the introducer. Well, it's very much of an honor for me to introduce Mina Bissell to you, and very appropriate that your series is called Women We Admire, because I think that Mina is one of the women I most admire, and she definitely has profound influence on me in my career at the lab. Let me just say a few words about Mina's career. In a nutshell, Mina has excelled at everything that she has ever done. Starting with being the top high school student in her native country of Iran, receiving awards for that. Then she came to this country to study chemistry at UMR. Then she transferred to Harvard, where she got her undergraduate degree, and then stayed at Harvard to get both her master's and her PhD. Soon after, she came to Berkeley as a postdoc and then worked her way up as a staff scientist, a senior staff scientist. Now she's a distinguished scientist, of which I think there's only one or two. I think they're all retired except you.
So now I'm the only one?
I think you're the only one. Her list of awards and honors is just, I couldn't possibly tell you all of the many that she has received, but let me just give you a few highlights. Of course, she's a member of the National Academy and the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. She's a recipient of the E.O. Lawrence Award, which is, I think, the highest scientific honor of the Department of Energy. She has won many other awards. She's been a TED Fellow. She's been a Susan G. Komen awardee. And she's even had awards named after her. There's the Mina J. Bissell Award in Portugal. And she's received honorary degrees, et cetera. Served on many national committees and review boards, both nationally and internationally. And she has been on editorial boards for all the important journals in her field. She has many patents in her name. Et cetera, et cetera. It's a very, very impressive CV. But the thing I really want to say about Mina is not only has she excelled in her professional career as a researcher and scientist, but she is, if she were a man, I would say she's a mensch. Maybe you can say that about a woman, too.
No.
She cares about the people in her lab. She's been a tireless promoter, especially of women and minorities. Her lab, and even when I came to the lab as a postdoc and then became a staff scientist and senior scientist, Mina always had encouraging words for me. She always took the time to talk to me, even though she's being in life sciences and I'm in physics, we're in a completely different field. But she really touched me in my career, and I looked to her as a role model who, and not only excelled in her research. But she's also a wife and mother of two very accomplished children. So she really sets a standard that we can all aspire to, and at the same time, she really lends a helping hand helping people in their careers. So it's really an honor and a privilege to introduce Mina to you.
Thank you, Natalie. I'm honored to have to be introduced by you. That chair is empty, and you can put all my junk upstairs so if somebody else comes up, they can sit down. So I'm very pleased to be here, and I always debate. It's like even in my scientific talk, I always debate about what on earth I'm going to show, because it's like having 370 kids and you want to choose among them of all the different kind of work we have done. But when I talk to women, I usually also give them some science because I think it's really important to actually know what a person does. So so I put this title, I'm going to go through this quickly. For those of you who have 17 minutes, oh, we have another gentleman. That's wonderful. So the two, and my fellow from China who just came to the lab for a year and doesn't speak that good English, all of a sudden showed up downstairs. He thought this was an open thing and he had never heard me. So and he was about to leave when I said this is about women. And I said, no, you got it. So I am going to, actually, I think this next one refers to an article that the San Francisco Chronicle guy wrote many years ago about me called White Mother Scientist. And the women were outraged. And they said, husband, father, writer is a prejudiced man. Why in that order, you know, to start with the white mother scientist? But I actually like this because, and I usually say, or is it the other way around? It's just for me, they all intertwine. And there's really, I could say it in any which order, and it would be perfectly fine to do. Despite what the kind introduction Natalie did, when people ask me, how did you do all these things? You know, I was also the director of the first division at Lawrence Berkeley Lab in biology. In fact, the first division of cell and molecular biology. And then for 16 years, all of the biology was under me, and I was going crazy trying to deal with that, trying to my kids. I had a teenage daughter who was a teenager until she was 40. How did you do it? And I say, badly. I mean, and I am serious. But it's not everybody does it badly. How could we do all these things, you know? But on the other hand, the guys do it worse than we do. Yeah. They do one thing good, yeah, and then a whole lot of other things really bad. My feeling is that it's really important to actually have the guys hear these talks too. You know, it's okay to be a white mother scientist. It's okay to be a husband father scientist or whatever you are. You got to combine them. You got to integrate them. And my talk is all about integration. So I am going to, I had one picture that I just discovered. That's mm-hmm. me when I was 18. And that's the Shah of Iran. And he was giving me a medal. And you notice that I neither have a scarf, let alone a parka, let alone whatever. People misunderstand so much about Iran. Iranians are not Arabs. They were invaded by Arabs in the 7th century. They have a 5,000-year history. And a very interesting thing about Iranian women is that I haven't been back since the Shah fell. You can imagine. If I had gone in the early part of that so-called revolution, I would have gone straight to jail. So my mom said, everybody should come except me, because I'm so outspoken. If they had told me to put this thing on your head, I would say, go jump, and then that would be the end of it. So I haven't gone back. But the things I'm here, which are quite interesting, is that right now, across the country, 58% of entering class in engineering, in architecture, in medicine, are women in Iran. And the thing that blew my mind, I was in Manchester and it was a woman who had just gone to the Tehran University. She is a structural biologist and she's interested in women in the developing countries. She didn't know I was Iranian and we were having a round table with reporters and she said, my God, I just came back from Tehran and 62% of the faculty in Tehran University are women. Now, think about that. And people always say to me, Isn't it nice you ran away to be able to do this? And I say, hey, I do what I do precisely because I came from God. Women were expected to achieve. I mean, admittedly, I must say, Iran, as a lot of other places, is a class country. So is U.S. these days, unfortunately. And that women in the upper middle classes, I had a very educated family, and they all had children, but of course they had grandmothers and nannies and stuff. And when I had my daughter first year graduate school at Harvard Medical School, when there was one woman faculty, three women students, and 200 men. So when I showed up pregnant, first year graduate school, I almost got thrown out. And in fact, with my son, when I got the job, I arrived, I gave a talk at 3 months, and then 3 months pregnant, didn't announce that I'm pregnant. And they gave me a job at Melvin Calvin's division of physical biosciences. And Melvin, Dr. Calvin, had a real phobia. And so I show up 7 months pregnant to go start my job. He took a look at me. I came through the door, came here, and he said, "You're fired." This was 1972. I got fired. And people have to go struggle and say, "What are you doing?" And he said, "Well, women who are pregnant have no business in the lab." And then they banned me from going to the lab that I had come to set up. It's a very crazy story in those days. I had no idea how women in the U.S. in the 60s, I mean, you only have to watch Mad Men to know what it was like, right? I had no idea. That certainly was not the case with me. Now, I must say, I'm also lucky in some way that there were only two daughters. And my father was extremely supportive. And my main thing to men is that the way women achieve has a lot to do with how their father views them. If I hadn't gotten a PhD, and I admittedly my mom was very, I tell you about that a little bit later. I really do want to give you a little science. So it has been a long journey, but it has been a wonderful journey. I wouldn't do it anything otherwise. But I brought you a couple of things. One article in New York Times that blew my mind when it appeared on the first page, and then the whole page, whatever, I thought it was going to be three sentences in the science section. And they talked to me about what has been so difficult for you, et cetera. And then there's another one where it's just one page, and it says the power of persistence. And I thought you could look at that, and I can actually explain some of the puzzles in there if I don't get on time to finish this. Okay, now without much ado, I want to tell you a little bit about my career and why I do what I do. So you remember that the name of the work, this thing was supposed to turn. This is a section of the breast. And it has the most gorgeous structure that you ever think about. It has these different layers of cells. And remember when I first showed it was turning. I don't know what happened. It stopped. And the thing that I want to tell you, and I'm going to teach you a little bit of biology in about a single cell. Okay. When your mom and dad met, there was an egg and a sperm. They came together, right? So this thing goes like that, divides, divides, divides. Then it becomes an embryo, and then it does this. Now, I put on the board TED, which is a TED talk I gave. It's only 17 minutes. And if you put on your YouTube, you put TED Minogue, so it will come up. And it sort of summarizes what I'm telling you. My audience were 600 non-scientists, so I had to kind of do this without, and I was late to that, and I tell you. But the night before I arrived there, they had said, oh, did you get permission to show her picture? We just heard that they want money. Can you imagine this? I mean, to be honest, and I had come from Maine to Scotland. I was in Glasgow. I was exhausted. I had had 4 hours of sleep. They hadn't had time to rehearse me. They said, "You can't do this. You can't do this. You're talking about too many things." I said, "Just trust me. Just let me do it." And it was awful. So what are we going to put in place of that? And, you know, to have permission. So he said, "Well, we need somebody everybody recognizes." And everybody looked at each other and said, "Oh, Obama." And so we stuck Obama there. And I heard from thousands of people. They said, "Oh, we, and they asked questions. Two people objected. And I will tell you about that later. It's really amazing. And I thought that was so funny. And he said, "Why can't you have a woman? Why can't you have, why are you choosing this stuff?" I said, "For crying out loud, he's the president of the United States. Shape up, you know, what is it, whatever." So, but I told him that, you know, this is what I had to do. Okay, the point of this slide is this. You start with a single cell that has a mixture of your mom and dad. That you can't change, okay? But you know how many cells you have? I'm not even sure. I didn't put that. You know how many cells you have in your body? Somewhere between 10 trillion and 70 trillion. I don't know who counted it, but that. So 70 trillion cells in your body, they all have the same genetic information. They all have the same genetic information. So now look, your finger, your nose, your mouth, your breast, prostate for the two guys. What, three guys? Wonderful. And how do they become the way they are? What happens? Every time you look at yourself in the mirror, you have to say, the same thing, the same thing. The same. Why is that? How does it nose to be a nose, and why doesn't it turn into your elbow one morning? Now, if you really, I used to say that to people, and people would say, "Oh, she's over the top, blah, blah." And I would say, you now have to remember what happened about 10 years ago. You opened your newspaper, and on the top of the picture of the newspaper was somebody in Scotland took a cell from the frozen mammary gland of a sheep. What did they do? They made the whole sheep. What does that tell you? That tells you that even your adult selves have the ability to clone themselves if they were in the right place. Now, why isn't this obvious to the director of our National Cancer Institute? I don't know. But everybody sequences, everybody says genes are your destiny. Well, Christ, I was in Texas and I said that. So the genes are your destiny, sure. But the genes, once you are who you are not your destiny. You can actually do a whole lot of things about them. Now, if you take, so people then discover this thing called oncogene, which means a gene that causes cancer, and they discovered this, it was discovered in 1911 by a guy called Rouse. And this is called Rouse sarcoma virus and forms a big tumor in the chicken. Yeah? So he discovered the chicken, he took the tumor, he filtered it, injected back into the chicken and got another tumor. So it was the first demonstration that the oncogenic, a cancer-causing virus, can cause tumors. Then people isolated the filtrate of this thing and they started dumping it on cells in culture. They had isolated cells in culture from chickens or from mice or whatever. And it would pile up a little bit rather than being a flat sheet. And all the biologists and molecular biologists, when I came to do my postdoc and I came to work with this virus, I was a chemist, as you heard from Natalie, and after that I was a bacterial geneticist. So I had never actually done regular biology, and I think that was a shame, but at the same time was my blessing. because I wasn't corrupted by these textbooks. And they just ram it down your throat, and it's all dead, because science, by definition, is moving. And I kept, so the kids who are trying to do science, they just say, this is what I should find, because the gene rules, or this happens, or whatever. And they don't look at the results. And I, from day one, when I started doing this, I said, this didn't make sense to me, that a single oncogene could cause the tumor, despite what it is that people had isolated. It was a single virus, but it wasn't a single oncogene, okay, a single cancer gene. You have 70 trillion cells in your body. So even if 0.00001 of that gets mutated, and of those, 0.00001 has some oncogenic property, you would be a huge, big tumor. Or you would be a lump of some sort, and you wouldn't be who you are. And yet you're not. And that describes my title, Why Don't We Get More Cancer? In fact, everybody says, why do we get so many cancers? The question is not that. The question is, why don't we get more? Because as you age, the rate of cancer goes up like that. Aging is the worst risk factor for cancer. And when people say, oh, eradicate cancer, I said, can you eradicate aging? You've got to die of something, you know. Nobody thinks about that. They all just consider this. And I think that we are on the wrong track as we deal with cancer. So when I was, when I had my own lab, and then I had a really bright and a very unfocused kid that I had to rehabilitate from drugs, and I had to do it. In those days, nobody wanted to work with me because I wasn't working on sequencing a gene or doing whatever. They had no idea what I was doing. So this kid and I decided that we are going to do a really crazy experiment because we read a paper that if you inject the virus into the chicken embryo rather than the chicken, it doesn't make tumors. And people hadn't dismissed this. This was published in 1940s or something. And so we got a very clear virus that was pure. We got an egg from a chicken that didn't have an immune response to repel the virus. We injected it into the chicken embryo wing, and we showed that this wing had the virus. The virus was active, the oncogene was active, and it didn't make a tumor. We published this in one of our fancy journals called Nature, and in 1984, nobody paid attention. It didn't make any sense to anybody. They thought, oh, there's no idea. So I thought, well, we got to do something else. And in that article of New York Times, you will see that that Gino Colotto, who is our most famous reporter for science, is actually got hooked on this story. She didn't want to hear the rest of the stuff I'm telling you, and that's what she wants to write about. And so it has a lot to do with wounding, with inflammation, et cetera. I don't have time to tell you about that. But people wouldn't believe us. So then I said, well, what are we going to do? Let's take the gene that is a cancer gene. Let's attach a reporter gene, which is color. We can do that to that gene. We can engineer genes. And we can color the oncogene so when it is expressed, this cell becomes blue. So you have no doubt that you have the oncogene there, yeah? So we did this experiment. And this beautiful feather here, you see every blue cell here could be a tumor if you injected this into the chicken. But in the embryo, it's just part of the beautiful feather. And the embryo doesn't begin to even fall apart and get the machine until just at the time it's hatching. But this was early stage. Now, if we take this feather and dissociate all the cells and then put it in a culture, then it gets mass transformed and the blue cells pile up. So in the chicken, you get a tube. In the embryo, you don't. When you take the cell out of the embryo and you put them in a tissue culture dish, now you get another indication of malignancy. So what does that tell you? I don't know if I put that down. That says that context, i.e. the microenvironment, which is around that gene, actually determines what even a potent oncogene can do. Right? Does that, is that good? Mm-hmm. So one big question was, how does context signal? Everybody said genes rule. Well, they do in a way, but they don't in a way. In fact, I rest my case that this, the gene here and the gene here are the same, and clearly the phenotypes are different, right? So, and when I say this to people, after, at the end of my talk, they say, oh my God, why am I doing these studies in two dimensions? So I would be doing experiment in chicken and RSV and whatever, and I was also doing some other crazy stuff like glucose metabolism. Nobody wanted to look at that. It's gotten popular again, but nobody wanted to do that. And nobody would listen. I mean, I have all my energy. They liked the fact that I got up there and talked and whatever, but nobody would listen to the content. And I thought, what am I going to do to get people to pay attention? It is fundamental. Fundamental about the fact that the microenvironment of that particular cell actually determines what that cell can be a normal cell or not. Okay? And the reason that aging is such a huge risk factor is because your microenvironment has aged and it does all sorts of wrong things. So we decided, oh, this is a huge question, how do the treatment itself? Okay? So this how is the heart of it. So I decided we will choose a mammalian cell, and we will choose mammary gland. I didn't choose it initially for breast cancer. I chose it as a model. But I was bacteriology. I could model this. And I said, okay, mammary gland is like an experimental organism. Why? When you're born, both men and women have a tiny little anlaga. They call it anlaga. And men have nipples, as you know, and it doesn't go anywhere because they don't, thank goodness, get the puberty hormones. When the girls get the puberty hormones, now that anlaga starts growing, and what happens is that here, this is the fat pad, this is a section from a mouse mammary gland. These are the little things of the mammary gland that I should have shown you a drawing and not an actual picture. That's easier to see, but I didn't have time. I looked for my old slides, couldn't find them. So when the animal gets pregnant or the females get pregnant, these cells start growing and growing and growing, and these are the cells that get tumors, right? But in pregnancy, they grow, and in lactation, they become these beautiful things that secrete the milk into here, and they send it to the lumen. And when they take the babies away, the gland is called what's called involution. So the gland changes completely like an organism and comes back all the way here, ready for another pregnancy. Right? Okay. And here is milk. You see here, this is a milk protein. Here is one in here. You see virgin glands, the animals that are with virgin or the women who haven't had children. You don't have to be a virgin. But here is what doesn't, there's no milk. In pregnancy, they start making milk, but they don't secrete it. And in lactation, it goes way up, and they secrete the milk, and it all comes to the. And when the involution comes, you see that it's on its way to glomerulus. So it just changes magnificently. And here is a picture of a woman's breast. We have these beautiful branching things. We have five or six of those. And here is the nipple. And the thing that I showed you there is one of these things in the tip that when the animal or the female gets pregnant, then that makes this thing, okay, which is what I showed you, where the milk goes. Okay, milk goes here, and here is two layers of different cells. They're beautiful. They secrete something called extracellular matrix, huge, large molecules that are insoluble, and they surround the shape. And everybody thought this was simply to keep their structure, okay? And then the milk goes down here when the baby sucks. So we said, well, this is too complicated. The animal is too complicated. We want to put these cells in culture, in tissue culture, and find out how they remember to make milk. Why doesn't eye make milk? Why doesn't your finger make milk? They all have the same hormones, right? Only now you can make milk. And your skin does melatonin. This does what? Okay. So if you now look at this cell that came out, this is such an old slide, it's 30 years old. This electron microscopy. This is one of those cells. Here is the fat droplet. Here is the nuclei, gorgeous. Here is the bottom where that extracellular matrix and stuff are. And here are the secretions. Okay? You see how beautiful it is. This is one single cell. You take these cells out of the mouse, you put them in a dish, you give them all the hormones they want, all the growth factors they want, and you say, now I'm going to find out how they make milk. Well, in 3 days, they turn into this. This is the same magnification. They go flat. Look at the nuclei. Fat droplets are gone. And there is zero milk. 3 days ago, 2 days ago, in the animal, they had to say, you crazy cells, what on earth happened to you? What on earth happened? Now, the reason it's fun to be at Lawrence Berkeley Lab is that physicists are naive in biology, but they're smart. So when I say to some of the kids, what do you think is happening? They say, oh, there's something here that is not here. That thing was signaling to the cells, you are in mammary gland. This thing doesn't have that. I mean, they didn't say that, I just don't. But when I asked them, when I talked to the kids, I said, tell me what's going on. And they all say that. They are not corrupted. So, what was there? And I began to think, hey, this thing that I told you about extracellular matrix, so I began to read about it. I knew nothing about it. And I had a postdoc who taught me about this, another postdoc who taught me about that. And I said, hey, kids, this stuff outside have information. They actually are telling themselves what to do. And they have to have receptors at the cell surface to get the signal. That receptor has to transmit messages into the cytoplasm. That has to transmit messages to the nucleus, and the nucleus has to take the chromatin. You see, your chromosomes is a mixture of protein and whatever, and it's that chromatin that reorganizes. And the genes here that are expressed that make their protein here and here are entirely different. That's how the same genes do these different things. And what gives them the message? I argue it's extracellular matrix. And that was complete heresy. Because it said that phenotype, which is what you look at, is dominant over genotype. Now, everybody should have seen that if they had thought about it. You look at yourself in the mirror, you say, the same genes. And the biologists were making excuses about why these are different. Because there is terminal differentiation, meaning once you're a nose, you're always a nose. That's completely false. Once a mammary gland, you're not always a mammary gland. So I said, what is it that does this? So to make a very long story short, we made from a tumor or something or the other, some of this gooey material that is around you, we put the cells there, and in about 4 days, they made this. And they made this, and here is the milk. Here is what's in vivo. Here is what's in culture. Even sizes are the same. And you have gobs and gobs of milk. They look gorgeous. Look at this. How beautiful they look. And this molecule, these that's what they do. Funny, I was in Berlin about 4 months ago, and I didn't show this because I said, people, you have seen this, you have heard me, and whatever. And this guy had driven from somewhere and came out, and during coffee break, came out and said, I keep inviting you, and you don't come. And you want to see something? So he pulled his shirt up, and his undershirt had that picture. I was afraid he had tattooed it. Reduction mammoplasty. So we don't go and cut people's breasts off. They do it themselves, right? So they have big breasts and they go do something, and the people were throwing it in the garbage, and now we take it out and we do it with human breasts. And the long and short of it is that's what they do. They do exactly what the mouse cells do. And then we said, okay, but they don't make milk. The human virgin, non-pregnant, there's a lot more steps in human than mice, so they don't stomach. But they do, you see, the structure is gorgeous. So we then argued we had no method for distinguishing normal and malignant cells from each other in culture. Okay? When you put them in two dimensions, they look the same for the epithelial cells. But if you put them in three dimensions, in the gel that we developed, all of a sudden, we said, oh, maybe we can use this three-dimensional technique for malignant cells and see what do they do. Maybe they remember to look malignant. Then you have a very quick assay for distinguishing normal and malignant. Are you still with me?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah? Okay. So we did that. And look at this. So here is a single normal cell growing, growing, growing. And when it gets around here, the rate of growth drops. And look at those. Those are not single cells. These things are that. This orange is nuclei, and this is the cytoskeleton. And those things are like that drawing I showed you, okay? Mm-hmm. They have 16 cells in them. And look, every one of them does. Now, we take malignant cells that we developed from that, and look at every one of them are malignant. And the beauty of this is now what we call clonal, meaning, remember, they start from a single cell and they make this. So if we took this out, this is a clonal population, and you can do molecular biology, biochemistry, do what. I'm going to run out of time. So we hypothesize that if I'm right saying that the architecture, the way I showed you for the chicken, and the way I showed you for the mammary gland, and the architecture of the tissue is the driving factor on how genes are expressed, okay? There is wisdom in your nose. There is wisdom in your mouth. There is wisdom in your liver, in your breast, in your prostate. They have been developed over millions of years to do all these things, all right? So I said, if this is true, somehow we should be able to make a malignant cell when we restore the architecture, even though the genome is malignant, it should become normal. Alternatively, if we take a perfectly good mouse that is normal and make engineer a mouse that destroys the architecture, those mice, without our gene, without giving them a cancer gene, they should get tumor as they age. And we have done both of these. And I don't have time to show you, but here are the non-malignant. Remember, this is this beautiful thing. This is that malignant cell. Look what a mess they are. This is active, whatever. So we found a way, and I don't have time to, I'm sorry, but any of you who are interested in biology, come and talk to me. But we found a way of lowering some kind of signaling molecule around these things. And when we did that, look what we got. We reverted the malignant phenotype. And every one of them does it. Oh, somebody has to move my cursor to the top. So what that cursor on the top, yeah. Now look at that. These are the malignant cells, and we gave them this, they are in three dimensions, and we gave somebody to lower something and look at it. Every one of them does it. And we have used this technique to find out a lot of new pathways. We have learned all sorts of most wonderful things. And I tell you, I'm not going to have time to show you except to say form and function are related dynamically and reciprocally. As you're sitting here, your 70 trillion cells are going. They are not constant. They are talking to each other like crazy. And what happens when you age? Your extracellular matrix, you know, these wrinkles are not good for you. They give the wrong message. When you're young, if you that's why exercise is good for you. That's why not having too much sugar is good for you. We have done, we can show that if we take the sugar away from the medium, the malignant cells will end up looking like this. If we give them too much sugar to the normal cells, they do that. We just published that in January of last year. Okay, form and function are related dynamically and reciprocally. Now, I'm not going, okay. I'm going to read you, I debated in college whether to do English literature or chemistry. In chemistry, but I still love literature. So this is a poem by Yeats. He says, "O chestnut tree, great-rooted blossomer, are you the leaf, the blossom, or the bulb? O body sway to music, O brightening glance, how can you tell the dancer from the dance?" Now, I use dance. And this is a very famous modern dancer of the old days. But look at it. He's dancing, and he's a dancer. Now, if he comes down and stops, you neither have the dance nor the dance. It is the same thing with hormone function. Yeah? When you mess it up, as you age, you mess up. And you increase formation of mutations that admittedly increase a whole lot of energy, but you have to have hundreds of them before you get cancer. Cancer takes 40 years before you get it, except for childhood cancer, which is completely different. And I was going to show you something really interesting, but I really don't have time, so I'm going to stop and not telling you that, because we show that the branching of the tissues is dependent on the shape. And this was a summary of my talk, but what I was going to show you, here I say, I just messed myself. Okay, so I tell people, especially the geneticists, what is important is not mutation alone, biochemical signaling alone, force and tension alone, it is the integration of chemical, mechanical, physical, biological, and as yet unknown processes that make you who you are. And they have perfected themselves through evolution to make the form and function. So herein lies the challenge of cancer and aging. How to prevent this integration of these exquisitely tuned principles. So what are these things? There's so little we know. And if you knew a lot of famous geneticists, famous Nobel Prize winners, all the biologists, they're arrogant. They think they know everything. I mean, so stupid. I mean, we know so little. Really, we know a lot, but we know so little. So I had this kid, a physicist, coming to my lab, and she says, "When is it you can't turn?" And I tell you, I've had four dumb physicists in my lab. There are a lot of physicists who think they can do anything they can, and they don't succeed in physics, so they come to biology and they mess us up. But in front of this physicist, I said this to Steve Chu, he nearly choked me. I said, "Steve, the road to hell is paved by physicists who think they're doing biology." Okay, so she said, "How do they do this?" I said, "I don't know. The first few days are really important." She said, "Have you looked at this thing?" I said, "Look, we don't have high resolution yet. I don't know." She said, "I'm going to do it." So she takes a single cell from an adult mammary gland and look at it. Did you know your cells can do this? That's how the mammary gland reorganizes. It's in that gelatinous stuff. it moves coherently and forms, you see, you're not saying that, form that beautiful asanas. They have to do this. That's why they can do it in 3D and not in 2D. Okay? Mm-hmm. So I developed this 3D. You have to think in 3D. There's nothing about you that is flat. Okay? So why is that? Because if you... Natalie, help me out. Please. Yeah. Do that and then do the other one. Now, oops. Push it. No? No, go ahead. Oh, the heck. Okay. Never mind. So what it does is that the normal cells attach to each other and form a scaffold when they divide. And that attachment forms the right extracellular matrix to give them the thing. The tumor cells, if you have seen it, you see them already. This is two cells, they are attached. This is two cells, you see they're separated. Now when we revert them, they come together and they attach. So I come back to this, to the end of my talk, and I say to all these people, 95 of whom are doing sequencing until you're blue in the face. And I say, we know everything about the human genome. We know the alphabet of the genome. We know the sequence of the genome. We know this, we know that. But here is water coming into the shore. Here is the coral. And here is the mammary gland. The mammary gland of the mammoth. How is it that nature does this over and over and over again? And that's why we need physicists and engineers and mathematicians and bioengineers. That's why I stayed in the National Lab, because you can bring all these different things together. So I say to the young people, I give a lot of talk only for them. And I say, don't go and say all the important thing has been done. In fact, we had a professor at Berkeley after DNA, the structure of DNA was discovered. He said, there is nothing exciting in biology left. We now know everything. Well, excuse me? So I say to them, what an opportunity. We know nothing about the language and alphabet of form. We know nothing. We now have done it for mammary glands. It's taken me 40 years. Now that I have put it together, I think people should be able to do it for absolutely all the other tissues. They are not all the same. They use the same signaling, but they do different things. Okay, you say, what an opportunity for the young and the parish to look old. And that's me. A whole new horizon to explore. So go to it. All right. And science is built up with facts, as is a house with a stone, but a collection of facts is no more science than a heap of a stone is a house. And this guy said that he was a mathematician, and this is my favorite. I love the way this cat looks. And the guy said, don't you ever dare. So this is the authorities, and this used to be me. Unfortunately, I have turned into one of those. So I say to people, don't believe me. Go look at your own data. Don't believe me. I tell every new postdoc and graduate student, your first task is to disprove our last paper. Now, if they can do it, it's fine. But if they could do it, it would be fun. We could then find something new, right? And the reason I'm so passionate is because breast cancer, despite the fact that you're doing so well, this lovely gal who was, you remember her? She was the secretary of the, or deputy director. She was modeling this after the breasts were removed. She died, and I don't want that to happen for my granddaughter. She's now 15, and I haven't had time to change this. She was in one of my lectures in L.A., and she says, Grandma, I am 12. Okay, and I went to France, and I came back. At that time, I had more money. Now DOE took $2 million of my money away. The head of the National Cancer Institute took my merit away. You know what merits are? No. They give it, your colleagues give it to you when you have done so well for your lifetime. He took it away after, he doesn't like me. So we made a human asset. So we had 8 different couples who had babies, and that's milk. And this is Lawrence Berkeley Lab. So don't mix us up with Lawrence Livermore. Right, guys? You I say to them after I give my talk? I say, you guys, even Secretary of Energy is mixed us up. What is this? Every time they make a mess, it's our fault. Every time we do anything good, they did it. And I said, they took the synchrotron radiation, the first accelerator that Lawrence made had this dome. So they put it on the top of the advanced light source. It has very, very powerful light source, and you can tell the structure of the protein. You can do all sorts of other wonderful things. And don't go yet. Just 1 second. What does that remind you of? What does that remind you of?
Breath.
And I say, no, you will never forget. Only women get away with it. Yes. Okay, guys, I'm done.
Thank you so much to Dr. Bissell and Dr. Rose for coming. And for everybody goes, we'll just do a quick. Oh, I should look at these two. I got a here.
Right? Now, did you put my name there? I hope.
Put your name in too. Actually,
yes, absolutely.
You're
our,
would you like to draw?
Because
you're our, sure. We have Natalie's
name in here?
No.
Okay. Antoinette. Yay! What a pretty name.
Okay.
All right, folks. And I'm happy to answer questions. I tell you, it was hard. It was very hard. Not only did I get fired by Melvin Calvin over and over again, it was absolutely amazing. Each time they had to go and argue with him. So after years and we had these seminars, and he would go for it. But I liked him because he did it to both men and women. He didn't discriminate. He was massive. But he would go for me. I would show a picture of the whatever, and he thought he knew everything. And he did a lot of things, you know, and he would say it, and he would be wrong, and oh, God. So one day I finally said to him, Dr. Calvin, everybody's afraid of you, and everybody calls you Dr. Calvin. I'm going to call you Melvin. That's what Americans do. Now, what is wrong with you? I said, look, I don't disagree with you because I think you do. I think you're one of the most brilliant men I know, but oh, kind of hell, you don't know everything. Why can't we have a discussion rather than you firing me all the time? He did. It went on for years. And I suddenly became my best friend. Nobody has done that to me. Nobody actually. And his children didn't talk to him. Yes, but...
Are you aware of the atmosphere at the Santa Barbara campus? Did you ever consider doing any of the modules using the atmosphere for the three-dimensional...
You mean with computers?
Yeah.
Yeah. No, we do that. I have bioinformaticists who have helped me how to put these things together with whatever. We have three-dimensional models. We have a whole lot of things. But it doesn't by itself necessarily tell you something. You have to go and test them. And we test them. And what I told you is very much similar to what actually happens. That if you don't have the extracellular matrix there, and if you don't have these signaling receptors that now people know a lot about and they're called integrins, you're not going to get the shape you get. And that movement that we just discovered 4 years ago, oh, what I didn't show you, this is my physicist. I love it because I show this stuff, and when she would come into the room, and I say to them, this is another example of context. She was born in Trinidad, and both mom and dad, he was an engineer and she was a school teacher, and they said, you're going to be a physicist, you're going to be, they sent her to a very good school, whatever. She was really, she now has an assistant professorship in National Cancer Institute, and she's doing her own thing. She's a little afraid, and I don't blame her, but she's absolutely wonderful. And now my group is sort of half this size because they took all my money away. But my feeling is it's all right. I'm getting old, and I have four grandchildren, 15, 12, 10, and 7. Three boys and one girl. Okay, that's it. Now, you have any other question I could answer, but this thing that I brought you, that one page, if you look at that, you hear more science, okay? You hear the repeat of what I said, so if part of it you didn't understand, maybe that was even more for general audience. I had to do it in 17 minutes, you know, 40 years of work in 17 minutes was hard. But the thing was that they asked me, a magazine called Nature Cell Biology, which again is a very good journal, and they asked different people, what changed your scientific career? What event made you do whatever? So I wrote that one page. And I have the craziest sentence at the end that may not make sense to you. Because at one point in my life, the director of the division, after Melvin Calvin, wanted my money, wanted my space. He was a well-known professor on Berkeley campus, and he wanted also something. And it was murder. I had just gotten my first two grants. And you see, you have to remember, university is just like hospitals or whatever. We're a playground for a lot of guys in the old days. Mm-hmm. And there weren't that many women around. And during the time that I was, you know, whatever, it was very hard. And this guy would not talk to me. He wanted to drive me out of the lab. And it was such a bad, it's not in there because that was too personal and too complicated. But the main thing was that I say to everybody, think of a second career. Because I was getting more and more depressed. I had gotten my two grants, one from NSF and one from DOE, and I wanted to hire some postdocs. He wouldn't sign off. He wanted to take 9/10 of my space away. He wanted to share the money, even though they were my grants. And he was just so, you know, in those old days, these guys did a whole lot of things that were totally non-kosher. But at one point, I just thought, what the heck am I going to do? And I was walking around the lake one time, and I thought, this was just before Christmas, and I had built already a small building with the money that Melvin Calvin had given me to build this thing to do tissue culture. And he wanted that lab, it was awful. And the director of LBNL was a professor and a dean at campus, and he had elected this guy. I'm not using a name because we're all UC people. So the problem was, but he's passed away, so I wouldn't probably tell this story. But I thought, I was just walking around and I thought, and everybody said to me, you're not going to win. You're not going to win if you go to the director of the laboratory. It's the guy he chose. It's his colleague. He just made him director. You know, directors can do what they want, and there's no way you're going. And I said, so then I thought, well, I'm going to go talk to him. I'm going to write a letter. I'm going to ask to go to a different division with some of my space and my money, which was a more biological division. And I said, I'm going to do it. And then I thought, well, what if I get thrown out? And I thought, I'll open a restaurant. And it's going to be a Persian restaurant. I have learned how to cook, and it's going to be a good one. The last line of that people don't understand, and I say, if it weren't, I'm using Dave Shirley's name in that. You should take a copy. You'll get it. I wrote it about my professor at Harvard who told me, you'll never make a scientist. Good dance. So he brought it in my face. It was the most amazing thing. So this guy and I wrote this letter, and I said, you're the director. You can do whatever you want, but I want my money. And this building I built, and just give me half of the building, and I'll go to the other division. Dave Shirley said to him, do you have your books open? What if you have audits? Are you going to be able to answer them? And then he said, Nina was responsible for this building. The building goes with her to the new division, like a dowry. And this guy had, when we walked into Dave Shirley's office, he had to stand down, Nina, where? And he explained what such a story. And when we were leaving, it was this, and oh, it was just such a beautiful victory. I say to the people, to the young people, think of a second career. because you never know. And it's not the end of earth. I say, you know, you went to school, you have your college degree, you have a PhD, you have a PhD. That means something. We don't train you to be professors, we train you to think. We train you to solve problems. Go solve problems. Do whatever. I can't tell you what the change it makes in their attitude. They're all like this, and they're all like that, and I hear from the master. And I say, exercise is good for your brain. That's why I look the way I do at my age, which is way up there. And it's my passion, too. And think of another possibility. You can't hack it. You can't get money for grants. You can't do whatever. Go do something else. And I think it's wonderful. And good luck to all of you.